Online video is rapidly transforming digital sales and marketing teams. But to truly be a master, you really need to understand the historical context. And that's what we discuss in this episode.
Discover how video can help you achieve your sales and marketing goals. It all starts right here in Todd Hartley's Video Marketing Mastery.
Now, for this episode, I wanted to introduce you to Jeremy Katz. You see, Jeremy is the worldwide editorial director at Ogilvy & Mather, who recently published their digital social contract. And inside of that is their video marketing report. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Todd. How are you doing today?
You know, I'm doing great, man. Thanks for finding time to talk with us about the digital social contract. And Jeremy, it does a great job first laying out the historical context of how traditional media morphed into where we are today, which is really digital and social engagement. So why is the historical field context important for marketers to understand?
Well, it's been said many times that those who don't study it or study history are compelled to repeat it. But the fact of the matter is that in this case, it's not so much that we're compelled to repeat it. It's that history is forcing our hands to replay the same mistakes that the first generation of television pioneers made when they were trying to understand the new media that was spreading out over the country. We are at an inflection point right now in our development in digital, and I think that inflection point has historical parallels. So if we're going to market well, it makes sense for us to look back at those historical parallels, find out what previous generations have learned, and try to avoid making some of the same mistakes or progress through the stages of adapting to the new media more quickly.
Okay. So that makes good sense for me, because before being a the CEO of a digital marketing agency that specializes in video, I was a TV guy and a talk show host and reporter. And I think when you're talking about these historical biases, these are like traditional broadcast rules. And to give you an example, I'll give you one. So I always like to record my open and close to these podcasts, just like I did a live radio interview, right? And, but that's a historical bias, because that isn't really relevant anymore. And if I want to create the best content, I need to properly tease the valuable information that's coming up. And the only way I can really do that is if I record my introduction after. Is that a historical bias that you're referencing?
That's exactly the kind of historical bias I'm referencing. When we talk about moving into a new medium, we naturally think, well, it's simply a case of doing what we've always been doing, but doing it in a way that makes a lot of sense for this new technology. But the fact of the matter is it doesn't necessarily transfer over perfectly. So, for example, your intro is based around a certain set of assumptions as to how the technology works. But we know from user data that the way people consume video and consume podcasts is extraordinarily different from the way they listen to live radio or watch live television. So we have to adapt to that new system. But those kinds of adaptations only become obvious once the technology has been widely used, and then once there's been a core of artisans that have developed new methods for making the technology sing in a way that really works with the user base.
Okay. So I understand what you're saying, and I want to see if I can explain this, because there is this type of bias and this type of different, it's a different medium which has different rules, and the adaptation to those new rules allow you to create more compelling content or better results. So for example, television, creating content for a television audience is really entertaining a passive audience, and online viewers are a more engaged audience. You have to create content differently. Talk to me about that.
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And it's really much more about as the phrase goes, it's more of a lean in versus a lean back kind of audience. So So I'll give you an example of one of the things that marketers do, which I think is particularly boneheaded. When you go to watch a video on YouTube right now, frequently you'll get a pre-roll ad. Now, that pre-roll ad may after 2 or 3 seconds, give you a little box that says skip ad, allowing you to go to the video that you want to see, or all too often, it doesn't happen. Now, that's simply an interruption of the entertainment stream for an audience that has become conditioned to expect no interruption whatsoever in the way that their entertainment is delivered to them. That is a holdover from a passive audience. An engaged active audience has the ability to click through or click off of an ad or click off of the content stream entirely if you interrupt their entertainment experience. So not only are you not getting your message across, but you're alienating the viewer, and you're really alienating them when you miss target. And I'll give you another example. Right before we debuted the digital social contract, I was doing a little digging in preparation for giving a panel talk. So I decided to go navigate to the YouTube channel of a woman who does DIY products for teens. Now, she's got something on the order of 4.5 million subscribers. She's very, very well respected amongst her community. She has high engagement levels. And this was a video that I clicked on that was about making your own school supplies. And it debuted right around September at the beginning of the school year. I launched the video and received a unskippable YouTube ad, which was essentially just a television commercial ported over to YouTube. That was bad enough. What was especially bad is it was for a GMC truck. So, I mean, huh? How did they get – not only did they get the audience wrong for the people who are watching her stuff, but let's say they're tracking me. I drive – a sedan, a little tiny sedan. I've never shopped for a truck in my entire life, nor will I ever. They got it wrong on every possible level. And that's an example of old habits of media planning, old habits of content creation, and a lack of respect for the new media on the part of advertising agencies. If we respected it according to what the kinds of engagements that these audiences could deliver, those kinds of mistakes would never happen. And we wrote this report in part to wake up our industry and get them to realize that this new world of online video content creators is an apex community. It is at the apex of a new world. They're leading the way, and we need to learn their habits and learn their methods of interaction so that when we engage them, we learn new patterns and don't repeat the mistakes of our ancestors when their habits become embedded in the rest of the media landscape, okay, which will happen.
Okay, so that's one of the things I absolutely loved was looking at the history that's laid out in this digital social contract. And then after I read the history that you and your team had laid out, which I, you know, lived through and witnessed and worked through, I started to recognize when my team was presenting historical bias solutions, and it was easy for me as a content creator to raise a flag. Now, when I was reading Ogilvy's digital social contract, I found myself out loud, Jeremy, saying, thank you, because I read in there that, you know, quote, the mobile generation hates to be sold to. And why is understanding that this generation hates to be sold to so important? Such an important lesson for today's video marketers. Talk to me about that.
I think that understanding that is one of the most important things.
Yep.
Because the whole notion of the way that revenue is generated by delivering a message that you, the brand, or you, the advertiser, want this person to get from you is outmoded. My son, who is 16 years old, used to watch PewDiePie, who is still the largest online content creator right now.
Right.
He's got something on the order of 40 million subscribers. He's got well over a billion views to his videos. PewDiePie has sponsors. Of course he does. He makes money, actually a very good living, through his videos. And part of that is from brands. PewDiePie's not selling those brands to his audience. He is integrating them almost in a product placement kind of way into his entertainment stream. They see them, they recognize them, and they form an attachment for them. That is a kind of selling that they would absolutely respond to and love to have happen to them. That does not impact the seamless experience that they have come to expect. However, if you drop an ad in, they're going to turn off. But why are they going to turn off, whereas the previous generation didn't turn off? And I think this is comes to what you said before. It's the mobile generation, and we coined that term in the course of this paper. And it's not just about mobility, although people talk about that. The key learning as far as not wanting to be sold to and the mobile generation is that for these kids and adults, I should say they're adults now, the notion that something has to stop at any point is foreign. If you've got a mobile phone, you wake up in the morning, you go downstairs, you eat breakfast, you get in the car, you go to school, you go to work, whatever. Your experience of whatever it is that you want to do is absolutely and totally uninterrupted. When it is interrupted, the signal drops or whatever, it's a catastrophe. For people who are older, like Todd, you or like me, interruption in something was normal. We were interrupted on television. We had to leave the house and couldn't answer that telephone call. We had to come home and get an answering machine. That's a foreign concept to the millennials and centennials. There is no notion of interruption in their lives anymore. So mobility has implications, just like the printing press had implications that aren't obvious until a generation has begun to live with the consequences of that technology.
It's so funny. As you're talking, I'm thinking about what my first job was around the house. And my first job was right when before the channel changer came out. I had older sisters. So my job was to stand next to the TV and then they would shake their head yes or no. And no meant change the channel. And, you know, now when we're creating content for a client, what you're really doing is you're trying to figure out how, if it's DIY or if it's for a product or service, you're really trying to figure out how you can be helpful to that audience. Helpful is the new viral. How do you get that information that you're providing to not feel salesy? And you can see that when it's someone like Michelle Fenn, who I think you were referencing earlier, is creating content to her specific audience, or if it's creating content to a client's target customers, you always want to be helpful to them and not feel, not give the impression that you're pitching and hawking products, which is a historical hangover from an era where you didn't have that interactability and you also didn't have people sitting forward. Instead, you had more of a passive sitting back, like you explained. You agree with all that?
I do, although I'd add a nuance to it.
Yep.
I think that this generation isn't opposed to learning about products and even having products hawked to them. However, they want to have that experience of being sold be itself part of the entertainment process.
Okay.
So when a video creator, for example, is talking about something new that he or she endorses and likes, so long as that product, that service, whatever it might be, is fully in line with the entertainment stream that they're delivering to the viewer and is authentic to the message and respectful of the community that they have nurtured and created, there is no opposition to having a commercial message delivered. Because presumably then, that commercial interest will pique the attention and interest of the audience as well because of the natural community affinities between the creator and the audience. It's where it's interruptive in terms of its format and also in terms of its actual product attributes.
Right.
I'll give you an example. An example from Ryan Higa. Ryan Higa has a channel called Niga Higa. Is very well known. He's got tons and tons and tons of followers. People adore him. He's quite funny. He endorsed a movie early on in his YouTube career, just when he was starting to break out. It wasn't a movie that had tremendous relevance to what he was doing, and he was absolutely roasted by his community. The sellout, the whole nine yards. Fast forward a few years, Ryan does a very big deal with Lenovo and is one of the people introducing the new Lenovo tablet to the world. Ryan did it in a video that felt like a Ryan Higa video because it was a Ryan Higa video. He did it in a way that was itself entertaining, that was itself of interest to his audience, and it was a product that they were they only to know about it, would be very, very excited to hear about. As a result, Ryan's video for Lenovo did fantastic business for Lenovo and further raised his profile among his community and increased his authenticity and his power with them. That's an example of how selling for this community can be fully integrated into the entertainment stream. I just think the problem is with the word selling. It's not really selling any longer, and I'd like to suggest that we substitute a different word, and we got to this at the end of the paper. It's not so much that you're involved in selling or hawking or promoting a product. What you're doing is you're vouching for something that you yourself use, right, love, and endorse. And that vouch is something where you're investing your own personal reputation and your own personal feelings about something into the recommendation to someone. So the creator and the brand have to form a different kind of attachment. The creator has actively placed part of his or her reputation in the hands of the brand. The brand has to be similarly trusting of the creator. And when that symbiotic relationship happens, a vouch can be seamless and accepted by the creator's community.
Oh, you are so spot on when you said that. It's a total symbiotic relationship. It's like a healthy marriage. It has a seamless feel to the audience when it's done right, and it feels disconnected and disingenuous when it's forced. In your digital social contract, you mention here four actions that I think are important, and the first one is so damn important. I want to take a few moments and talk about it. Why is honor community as king so important? Now, I'm a guy who started three large cancer awareness campaigns, and it was all done by boosting up the already existing community. And of course, because I did that and had authenticity and I was a member of that group, I got buy-in and support. So why is honor community as king so important for our audience to understand?
Well, I think that this is the age of community in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. And again, I'm sorry to keep going back to the historical parallels, but the reason this is called the digital social contract is because it's recalling Rousseau's original social contract. This is, I think, the beginning of a renegotiation of what we are starting to see in terms of how people view themselves in relationship to the community. It was back 500 years ago, the birth of the individual as came to full flowering in the American century. This sovereign individual, divorced of any real responsibilities to the community, where the rights of the nation were encoded into the individual's conduct through life. What this generation is beginning to do, and this is mediated by virtue of the community structures that they've been able to develop through technology, is start to renegotiate the notion of individuality. And we're starting to see this happening on American college campuses, where individuality isn't just what one person has the right to do. It's also what one community has the right to expect. And individuality is starting to become seen by this community as something that happens in relationship to the community. They are individuals as members of a community. They are individuals in association with communities. They are individuals as reflections of communities. That is so fundamentally different from what happened in previous generations, particularly our generation, Todd, that it is taking us a moment as a society to really adapt to it. And that is why you see in the press right now a lot of baby boomers in particular, not to be mean to the baby boomers, but baby boomers in particular, noticing that this generation feels coddled, doesn't want to be offended, all the negative terms that they're using when they're talking about how the assemblies of this generation are reacting to authority. Whereas in point of fact, it's not negative at all. It's merely that they're renegotiating the idea of individuality in a way that's different. Freedom of speech doesn't just apply to the individual. It applies to the community. Freedom from fear doesn't just apply to the individual. It applies to the community. And we have to understand that this is a new entity out there. Just as the 80s declared the corporation a person, well, I believe that this generation is declaring the community a sovereign person.
Okay. So in, you know, I lost count the number of times you use the word engagement in this paper. And this is really a crucial goal of video creators. You know, we've examined it as a brand as well. And how many times in my career have I gotten projects from television production companies that tried to leverage it over a video into the digital space. And then I was brought in to try to fix the engagement in that video. And it happens so often that it's a little sad. You know, what do you say to people when they're getting started on a video project to make sure that they're able to engage with that community and at the same time be able to get their message across?
Well, for one thing, they have to know from the very beginning what it is they're trying to actually achieve.
Right.
We have a paucity of measures for the online community in terms of what it is that we are trying to find out that they do. All we can really effectively measure easily and simply is reach and shares. And both of and likes, really. Both of them, or all three of those, rather, are really fairly unlimited. I mean, you can share something really easily. You can like something without any limitation whatsoever. And you know, reach is, you know, whether or not Facebook autoplayed it on your feed when you checked it, 13 seconds ago. So those measures are proximate at best. So what we ask, or what we ask of our brands and what we ask of ourselves is to think more deeply about what it is that you're actually trying to get happening from this community. So number one is, are you seeking to just boost your numbers of followers? Well, that's a reach play.
Right.
That has a place. But that only gets you so far. So are you instead asking them to share something? Okay, well, that's something, but is that sharing that you're doing actually going to be promoting of the brand, or are they just sharing something awfully fun or interesting or magnetic or whatever it might be? When you get down to it, what you really want them to do is you want them to nominate amongst themselves a group of what we call super fans, people who are incredibly excited about whatever it is that you're doing, your product, your service, whatever it might be. That core group of individuals can be the drivers of the vast majority of the revenue potential of whatever it is you're doing. So an engagement for those people looks so different.
And Jeremy, they're kind of an extended arm of the marketing team when done properly.
Yeah, they're your, you know, what I would call your primary vouch force.
That's right.
But what those people are, they're just a sales force for you, because they are endorsers of your product. They're users of your product. They're beta testers of your product. They're the people who are going to help direct you in the marketplace. This is what's needed next. This is what you ought to drop. This is what you ought to pursue. They're the people who are going to help dictate the terms of what your content stream ought to look like. And your goal with engagement is not necessarily to reach the largest number of people, but to activate the largest possible number of super fans. That's a very different measure. And I have to be honest with you, no one has yet quite figured out how to measure that. We're trying. And we published as part of this paper a list called the Ogilvy 30, which is the 30 most engaged content creators on video. And it has some surprises on it. For example, the person I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, PewDiePie, isn't on there, because though PewDiePie may have tremendous views and tremendous numbers of subscribers, his engagement isn't as robust as some of the less well-known gaming YouTube people. So what we're looking at is a series of firm measures in terms of sharing behavior and commenting behavior, but we're also looking at some fuzzy measures in terms of what appears to be velocity of engagement change. And those are the kinds of things that we unfortunately still have to measure somewhat manually.
Well, there's a, you know, we do this every month. We report into our clients on how our campaigns are doing for them. And they're the most important metrics have to be done manually. And, you know, that's one of the realities of where we are now, but eventually it's all going to be automated. And it's kind of fun to watch as you've been laying out the historical lessons and the opportunities that are in front of us as very sound marketers to make sure that we're learning as we go, adapting and shedding off the historical biases that take place. Jeremy, everything that we create here at Wirebuzz, the first thing we do when we meet a client is we have a strategy session. We bring in our strategy team. Because I've always found that the most video projects fail online because they tried to do too much, or there wasn't a very streamlined strategy from the beginning and had some original sin. And I always want to make sure that if a client is working with me, that I can get them from their, you know, from point A to point Z and have it execute the call to actions or whatever it might be in exactly like the client needs. And so strategy is always the first place for us. Do you see that as being a relevant starting spot?
I think strategy always has to be the first place to start for a brand. That doesn't mean that strategy is the first place that a content creator starts. But when talking to a content creator, even if that content creator is within your own organization, I think the first thing the brand needs to be coming to that conversation with is a very clear notion of what outcome they want to have and what method they want to get to that outcome. They need to know what the ambition of the work that they are seeking to commission is. And if they have a very clear sense of that ambition, they can communicate that to a creator in such a way that the creative constraints are broad enough to allow freedom and tight enough to really force the creator to be as vividly imaginative as possible. That's the essence of the way advertising briefing has always worked, and there's no reason that shouldn't continue to operate in the online video space.
Yeah.
With one, I would add one sort of important difference, which is that the control pendulum used to be firmly in the brand. I think we need to start to trust that creators know their communities and audiences in ways that planners and account people and brands just don't, can't, and never will. So while those constraints need to be there, the trust in the creator has to be absolute when it comes to an understanding of the people to whom that creator is speaking.
Because the brand can destroy the creation, right?
The brand cannot just destroy the creation. The brand, if done in a particularly ham-handed way, can alienate the creator from his or her audience.
Yeah.
And that would be disastrous because it wouldn't just hurt a creator and hurt a community. It would set back the real appearance of brands in this world, and I actually think that's a good. I think it's really wise that the online video world has a very clear and very lucrative commercial side to it, because when the money is there, great entertainment follows.
Okay. I'm so excited that you just said that, because I've often thought what you just said, but I've never put it into those words. And that was really well explained. Thank you very much for doing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, he's Jeremy Katz. He's the worldwide editorial director at Ogilvy & Mather. And as I mentioned earlier, they recently published their digital social contract. It has a really interesting video marketing report. You can get a hold of that on our site. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Todd. It was a wonderful opportunity.
Thank you. Jeremy and the Ogilvy team have been kind enough to make the full PDF version of their digital social contract available for anyone to download without even opting in. And you can find that inside of our show notes at wirebuzz.com/digital-social-contract. Now, if you need me to do that again, just rewind. It'll be a whole lot easier because it's a mouthful. Or you can just find the link in the show notes. All right. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of our show. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes if this podcast was valuable. And I look forward to bringing you a ton of other rock stars in video marketing and digital to help you advance your business. Video Marketing Mastery is brought to you by Wirebuzz, the digital marketing agency that specializes in video to amplify sales or marketing goals.